better way to do this. Let me show you a better way.
And we are live. Welcome, folks, to episode 3532 of the Survival Podcast. It's a Tuesday. Tuesday is usually a Just Jack show where I riff on something. That's what today is going to be. Today we're going to talk about the most valuable school that they take away from us as children. And honestly, I would use the phrase, it just didn't fit for a title, really. It's a long title as it is to be in a podcast feed, but they literally beat it out of us. And I don't mean like physically like beat it out of us, though maybe some do have that happen to them, unfortunately. By the way, I think if you strike a child, you need your ass beat, just saying. Really, I'll leave it at that. But it is kind of beaten out of us verbally, conditionally, and in a way of programming. And I don't want to give it away just yet because I want to see if anybody guesses it. And I've actually talked about this in the past, but it is a skill that you're born with. It is a skill that every child has. 5-6-year-old children are excellent at this skill. By the time they're 12, 13, 14, they're taught that this skill is bad. It's rude. It's something that we shouldn't be doing. What is it? I will leave it to the people in the live stream to take guesses at it, and I'll tell you when we jump into the show itself. First, I want to take care of our sponsors. Sponsor of the day number one today is Above Phone, where you can replace big tech with your own private ecosystem. I recommend, if you're not even sure if you want an Above Phone yet, go to abovephone.com. When you get there, there'll be a pop-up. Give them your name and email address. If you decide you don't want to hear from them anymore, you can opt right out. It works. I check that with every sponsor to make sure that they use a legitimate email marketing system and that they honor opt-outs when I take a sponsor. So you know you can trust that. If you fill that out, you're going to get access to 4 free seminars on how to improve your privacy and security in your day-to-day use of technology. And if you decide to buy an Above Phone and you're an MSB member, they will give you $75 off any phone on their site. MSB is $50 a year. Right there, you're covered for a year and a half of your MSB by one supporting vendor of the MSB. And really, your life will just be a little bit better and a little bit more secure if you take back your tech. Next up today, JM Bullion. JM Bullion is where I go if I'm going to stack silver. And do you know why? Well, let's see. They've been sponsoring this show right here since 2011. That's kind of a long time in the world of podcasting, given it's 2024. They have pricing that is as good or better than all the other silver houses out there. They have some really cool silver rounds, man, which is a great way to introduce kids to it. They do free shipping. They do a discount for MSB. And if there ever is a problem, which there never seems to be, I can contact the president of the company directly. I would just ask, if you're going to stack some silver and you're going to order it from a website, why would you use anybody other than JM Bullion? And remember, I say, as always, that silver and gold should make up around 5% of your net wealth as a wealth assurance program and an anonymous form of wealth that you can simply turn to your heirs. I'm a huge bull on Bitcoin, but I also see the place for silver and gold. I'm not like exclusion of one to the inclusion of the other type of person. I don't really understand purists no matter what world they're in. I think we take the most interesting and useful things in the world and we make them part of our lives. And we take the things with long track records as well, like silver and gold. Let me see if anybody got it right. I don't think anybody did. Somebody sort of got it right. Let's see if anybody used the right word here. This is sort of it. Fisher Ken says asking questions or asking for more cheese if it's my son. Where was somebody else that got it? Asking questions, asking for stuff, asking why, negotiations. These are all dancing around the world word that I'm going to use, but they're all in a way correct because they're all part of that. And the skill is selling. A skill is selling. You know, usually what people will say if you mention selling as a skill is that, you know, I'm not a salesperson, so I don't care. I don't need to do that. one time when I was really a young man and I was, you know, taking one of my first really big sales gigs. I was working for a technology company called Microtest that just a month after I took the job was bought out by a larger company called Fluke that I ended up doing the same job for about 3 years. But when I first went to work for this company, we had one of the big, you know, everybody goes to the headquarters, all the people come in from the field. I was there like as a brand new guy and they're doing this big speech. And the VP of the whole company got up in front of the audience. He said, "Everybody that's in sales, raise your hand." And there were exactly four regional salespeople, four inside salespeople that reported to us, and then our reps. There was about 100 people as far as reps that had come in. Not every rep firm sent all their reps, but we brought in, you know, at least a couple from every rep firm that we managed. I was managing 37 salespeople at the time. And so Jim, the VP, says, "Who's in sales in this company?" And basically you see like this smattering of hands, about 100 hands go up. And this is a company with like 600 people in. So he says, "Every single person in this room that did not raise your hand, you should be ashamed of yourself. The company and its future is your future. You work here. You have a career here." And this was a great, before they sold the company, this was a, that's why I took the job. It was a great company to work for. He's like, "Every one of you, every one of you should be selling this company in some way at all times if you care about your future here." And when I say good company, I mean they had stock purchase options, profit sharing. Like literally, if you made the company better in any way, you benefited. I think that's always true to a degree with most companies until you get into the ridiculous sized ones. But no, he was right. Then he said, "Everybody that did raise your hand, please raise your hand again." And then he said, to quote Winston Churchill, "Never have so many owed so much to so few." Those people put food on your family's plate every night, and that's what you should be doing with their day. If you can't tell, that made an impression on me. I was in my 20s. I was like 26 or 27 when that happened. It was a long time ago as a young man. But it stuck with me. Now, here I am, you know, 20-odd years later telling you this story. So it definitely stuck with me. But it's bigger than that. You tell me you don't need to sell, and I'll tell you, well, then you don't want things in life. You don't want anything if you don't sell. You don't want a better job, a better career, a better place in life, to negotiate with anybody. It's all selling. Let me explain something to you. I have an absolute definition of the word sell or sales. And I got the term absolute definition from one of my prior business partners, Neil Franklin. This is a dude that won the Branson Award, as in Richard Branson, twice. Only person on planet Earth that won that award twice. Many have won it once. He won it twice, 2 years in a row, by the way. And he said, when I told him my definition of sales, he said, "That's an absolute definition." I said, "What the hell does that mean?" He said, "It's very simple. It's easy to understand and nothing else needs to be said." So my definition of sales is a transfer of belief. That's it. Transfer of belief. Three words. Defines the whole thing. Up doesn't even count. It's a linker. Transfer of belief. If you take it down to two words, if the person you're talking to is intuitive and can understand things and complete things for themselves. What I mean is that if I present you with something that I believe will benefit you, and it really will, and I take that belief that I have and I transfer it to you, if you have the money and the opportunity and I'm right and I'm doing it ethically, you're probably going to buy. But it's so much bigger than buying. How do you get a date? How do you get a date with somebody? "Hey, would you like to go out?" "No, piss off." "Okay, I didn't get a date." That sells. That's called cold calling, by the way. But the way you transfer a belief and get a date is, "Hey, I'm worth spending some time with to get to know better, and maybe it goes somewhere and maybe it doesn't." But you're transferring that belief that, "Hey, you and I, if we go do something together, there might be something that would progress from there," right? And you can say the same thing in a different way without the romance in making a friend. When you approach somebody that you've just met and you say, "Hey, man, why don't we hang out, or why don't we go fishing, or why don't we grab a bite," or something like that, that's transferring a belief that I am worth spending time with. If you go to somebody at your job and seek mentorship, somebody higher up than you, somebody that's been successful, maybe you don't really work for them. They're kind of lateral across from you, but they're much more successful than you. And you seek out their mentorship so that you can become as successful as they are. Are you not selling? Are you not transferring the belief that, like, I'll tell you something about successful people. My time is fucking valuable because I'm successful. If you want me to spend time and invest time in you, I better believe that you're worth my investment. Because that's what mentorship is. It's an investment with no direct return. There might be a long-term indirect return. Some of the people I mentored in my life later did work for me in different companies and had loyalty to me, or I can get things done. But in the end, the real benefit to being a mentor is seeing what the person you've mentored has done. That's why my best days are when I open my email first thing in the morning and I have a success story from somebody in this audience. I built a business. We had a disaster and it didn't matter because we were prepared for it. We've moved. We have a new house. We paid off our debt. That's my virtual mentorship dividend check coming in. But without the transfer of belief, none of it happens. What about getting into school? Now, I know there's people that have to get their kids into like kindergarten because some shit or whatever. I'm not talking about that. I'm not like, if you're actually a good candidate for college and you want to get into actually a competitive college in a competitive space, like you're trying to get into engineering school at freaking MIT, something like that. Don't you have to transfer a belief to the admissions board that you are worth taking a shot with? Yeah. Having money, like in a scholarship or some funding available where they know you can pay the bill, helps. But that's still transferring a belief. I'm a good student and I can pay my bill. I'll complete it. How about getting on a team? Any team that's not like, you know, your mom signs you up and drops you off and you're just on the team. You have to actually sell yourself. Sure, you have to have skill. But tell me coaches don't sometimes look at a guy and go, you know, I got three people I have left and one I can take and two I have to cut. And one might be just a little bit better, just a little bit better. But the other one is going to try harder, do more, and value it more. Who's he going to pick? The one that transfers that belief to him. What about getting a job? I don't need to know how to sell. I can't find a job. Huh, maybe you should learn how to sell yourself. You see what I'm saying, guys? Like, your whole life is a series of sales calls. Everything that you want to accomplish. Like, we've made selling a bad word. It's crazy. It's crazy. How about when you're a little kid and you wanted a toy? How does a little kid get a toy? Mommy, I want this. And that child could be transferring any kind of or set of beliefs, and they're really good at it. They walk through, don't they? Well, you should get it for me because I'm your kid and it's not that expensive and I want it. Oh, that didn't work? Oh, but look at all the things that it does, Mommy. It'll do this and it'll do that and I'll go play and it'll be fun. And that's basically saying, I want you to believe that if you buy me this thing, your child will be happier and I'll go do something and leave you alone. And it might even go all the way to the point of, I'll stop pestering you if you say yes. And I'm not saying we should always say yes, but we should recognize the innate ability of that child. See, we are born with this skill. We are born with this skill, and the only thing that separates us from manifesting this skill is language. See, a baby just cries, screams, and craps its pants and pees, right? It can't really communicate. That's why sometimes, you know what baby rage is? Have you ever seen real baby rage? The brain has developed sufficient to actually calculate things. I want this. But the brain has not developed the language skill yet to communicate it. You know, kids are like 6 months old. Maybe they have one or two words. And they want something from you, but they can't explain it to you. And they go into a full-on, have you seen it? I've seen it. I don't hold it against the kid. Very frustrating. I know what I want. Why doesn't mommy know what I want? Why doesn't daddy know what I want? I'll rage. That's an attempt to sell, attempt to transfer belief, but says the communication is not there. The ability to confer what I want isn't there. It results in anger, in rage. But then they start to develop words. They say mama and dada and puppy and kitten and sister and brother and aunt and uncle and papa and grandma. And then all of a sudden they start putting sentences together. How long is it once a kid can speak in a rudimentary complete sentence, maybe not perfect grammatically or anything, before they start saying, I want this, and here's why you should give it to me. That's selling. I want a thing, and here's why you should give it to me. So what do? We beat the living crap out of them, don't we? So grandma comes over and goes, let's see if I have any money for the kids, and she pulls out a five for both the kids, and we say, don't take that. Don't take that. Wait a minute, why not? Grandma came. Grandma's decided she wants to share money with it. Why are we telling them no? But when we really get on them is when they ask for something. Can I have seconds for dessert? You can say no. They need to learn. Like, if you're going to be a salesperson in life, whether it's a profession or just you understand that's your whole role in life, if you can't handle no, you're not going to make it. Every single salesperson I've ever had work for me that was suffering in their numbers, they weren't performing the way they should, no matter what their excuses were, right? And when you have like a great sales team and everybody's numbers are down about the same, you can attribute that somewhat to market conditions. We're still going to try harder, do something different, change something up. But when everybody's down, okay. But when you have two or three people out of 30 down and they blame it on market conditions or whatever, no, it's not. You know the number one reason they're not getting enough yeses. Can anybody tell me in the live feed here? I'll give you a second on it. And I don't know how long the lag is. So let me start. I'm going to let that hang for a second. If you're not getting enough yeses, what does it mean? What does it mean as a salesperson? But we beat this human ability out of people. We suppress it. It's rude to ask what you want for what you want from people, especially if they might give it to you, right? And it's even worse if you're good at it. Like the kid that can always get what they want, like we really suppress that, don't we? Not selling themselves good enough. Here's some of the answers coming in. Not asking enough. Yeah. But what does that all result in? Legacy Farm has it. Not getting enough no's. Every salesperson that's not making their number, as long as the number is a reasonable number, and this applies to everything in life, not just salespeople. We can take the salesperson and use them to understand life. They didn't get enough no's. The kid that can't get a date to the prom, did you ask every girl that you'd be willing to go with to the prom? No, then that's why you didn't get a yes. I promise you, unless you like really have something like a unicorn head growing out of your ass or something, and even today you might get a date anyway, you are going to get there. Lack of pipeline, that's not enough no's. If you can get enough no's, you will get enough yeses. It really is that simple. So when a child asks for something and the answer is going to be no, we should say no. We should hear them out and say, we've heard you out. The answer is no. But thanks for asking, and maybe some other time we'll do this, but now we're going to move on. And if they become a problem after that, then yes, you can employ some level of discipline, but don't ever tell them they were wrong for asking. Because what's going to happen is this kid is going to hear this shit from you and their teachers and their aunts and their uncles and their grandparents from the time they're about 4 years old and able to string sentences together until they're 18 years old and a senior in high school, and you're going to go, why don't you have a girlfriend? Have you applied for a job? Have you applied for college? And then you're going to sit there and act like you can't comprehend why they haven't done all these things. You just spent the last 14 years telling them not to do it. And now they're not doing it and you're not happy. And every freaking institution does this. And I'll tell you why. Because what is the foundation of a libertarian society? What is the foundation of a society based on liberty? What is the foundation of all initial civilization? And the answer is commerce, trade, barter, the exchange of value. This is why civilizations formed. This is why groups stop seeing each other and attacking each other instantly because, hey, they may have something I want. If I kill them and take it away, I can't get more of it. I killed the goose with the golden egg. It's almost like all these old nursery rhymes actually had deep innate lessons. You see what I'm saying? Right? So we have to stop beating things out of it. And legacy is saying voluntary association, but other people are closer to the market. Voluntary association to what? To exchange value with each other. Now, if you're trying to control a society, well, you really don't want a society that knows how to do that, do you? Do you know what you get when you have people who know how to sell their ideas well? You get open debate. You get open. I'm going to use a word here that if you take it as it's meant on TV today, it's ruined. So you can't. Open democratic debate. Okay? Democratic. Not what they call democracy. Open democratic debate. In other words, both sides are able to express themselves in a way that allows them to be fully understood. And then they can choose how they interact, but also anybody hearing that conversation can take from it what they will based on being fully informed by both sides. Well, fuck, we don't want that. That's horrible. That would be a divided or united, informed population capable of solving their own problems, working their shit out. How much do you need the state? I don't know. I'm going to say zero, but a hell of a lot less. No, you don't want that. You want compliance people. You want people that are told to do a thing and do a thing. You want people when they're told to shut up, they shut up. That's what you want. Well, what about the actual sales? Well, those people, well, that's the 10% that rise to the top. We'll pick those and skim them off and give them things to sell and tell them not to do it in the rest of their life. So this is also the number one reason I say people hate money. First, just as a straight up skill set. If you can sell, you can always earn six figures plus. You could sell doorknobs. You could sell freaking burglar alarms. You could sell water filtration systems. Like, these are not the places that I would say would be the best place to be in sales. I would rather sell definitely corporate to corporate, company to company, C-level, high value equipment. If I was going to go back into that world, that's what I want to do, because I close one deal, it's a $600,000 or $1.5 million deal. If I'm selling alarm systems, I got to sell 10 a day to make a living. But if you can sell, you're always marketable. You can always make money, and therefore you have a skill set that is modular and can be plugged into just about anything. If you want me to sell something and I don't know anything about it, all I lack is product knowledge. I don't need any other training. I don't need your version of how to sell. I don't need your closes. I don't need anything, because I have trained myself to sell. So all I need is product knowledge. You give me your product knowledge, your policies, your benefits, and your features. Features tell, benefits sell, right? And I put that together. I can sell fucking anything as long as it's not a piece of shit or I don't think the customer needs it, because I'm also ethical. See, what we've done is we've made selling like sleazy car salesman selling. How many of you drive a fucking car? And how do you get one? You go buy it. And when you go buy it, who sells it to you? A car salesman, right? And I admit, some of them, instant turn off. And I immediately shut them down and just get another one. I'm like, I don't need you. Go away. What? Well, I was here for, I don't care. I don't work that way. Go get me your sales manager. I'll talk to him or her. I'm not going to talk to you. I mean, I'm being pro sales here, but I'll also admit that, like, there are some negative aspects of sales. Like, don't lie. Don't lie. When I go buy a car, I tell the guy, look, I'm going to tell you right now, if you lie to me one time, you're done. I might still buy a car here, but it won't be from you. Do we understand each other? And they always are taken aback. And then I'm like, okay, let me explain what I mean by that. If I get to a point where I'm like, I'm interested in this vehicle right here, and you give me a price and you tell me it's the best you can do, and I ask you a second time, are you sure it's the best you can do? And you tell me yes. And then I tell you it's not good enough. And you say to me, let me go talk to my manager right there. Bring your manager to me and you're fucking out. And my wife goes, oh, Jack. No, it's more important. And when I go through my process for selling, you're going to see why, if you're a good salesman, you're like, I love this person. I love this person. Because you know what the honest salesperson is going to do? They're going to say, let me tell you how this works. And I'm going to go, I'm all ears. And they're going to go, I am going to give you the best number that I can give you. It may be the case there's a better number than what I can give you. I won't know until we get there. Fair enough. Fair enough. And that means that immediately when we get there, no matter what they give me for a number, I'm going to say no. And they know that. And then they're going to go to their manager and they're going to say, turns out that was the best I can do, or I can do a little bit better. And then maybe we're going to do a deal. But now I respect you because you were honest. You lie to me, you're dead. So part of my sales training, my sales philosophy that I've taught to others through my life, is you never lie to a prospect or a client, ever. And if you ever tell them something wrong, not because you were lying, but because you were wrong and you find out where you're wrong, you immediately go to that prospect and you say, let me tell you something. I made a mistake when I said this, and before we proceed in this deal, I want you to know I made this mistake. If that blows up your deal, it's better that it does it then than after the sale, 100% of the time. Next, you always need to be closing throughout your life, right? The ABCs of sales, always be closing, right? Remember Glenn Ross, always be closing, if you saw that movie. They did a SNL skit with Baldwin. I think it's the Baldwin that shot somebody in the movie, right? The one that just had his case dismissed. But he was on SNL and he did a thing. He was like Santa's workshop, and ABCs was always be cobbling, right? But we should be closing. And all I mean by that is closing is simply when you get to a certain point, you ask for the order. And that's a very salesy sounding thing, and it would be something that a salesperson would do. A close would be, so can I get your signature on the contract, right? And you put the contract down. And when you do that, you shut the fuck up. That's the most important thing that salespeople don't do, that they should be doing, is when you get to a close, shut up. Don't say anything until the person you're talking to responds. But it doesn't have to be closing a deal. Would you like to go out next week? Shut up. Don't say anything until they respond. Don't talk yourself out of a yes. So if we're always closing, that means we get to a certain point, we know that we've conveyed our information, we ask for a decision, and then we shut up. That's what closing actually is. Closing isn't, why not? But are you sure? Is there anything I can do to change your mind? Is there anything I can do to get you to go out with me Thursday? Is there anything I can do to put you in that new car today? Both of those, like, are sleazy, underhanded things that people just, like, immediately is a turnoff. So when you use these terms with people that have not been through becoming a professional salesperson, you have to explain that that's not what I mean. What I mean is ask for what you want and shut up. Always be willing to tell people what you want. This is the funny thing. People will sometimes give you what you ask for. And a lot of times the reason people don't give you what you want, they have no fucking idea what you want. Now, I'm going to say something that's going to piss some women off here. I'm sorry, but it's something I've noticed. I have had some excellent female salespeople. When I worked with Neil, my top recruiter made about $300,000 a year. She was a very pretty female. And it was not why she was good, because 90% of what she did on the phone, so you can't say it was her looks. She was very good. But in general, women have a harder time figuring out what they want. So if you don't tell somebody what you want, then it's impossible for them to give it to you. So you have to figure out what you want so that you can ask for it. The good news is, in a sales position, you know what you want. I'm selling a thing. I want you to buy it. Right. But I have seen kind of, and I think it's because women, I'm going to defend women. I think it's because women get beat up more for it than men as children for asking for what they want. Oh, honey, that's not how ladies behave. Bullshit. If you want something and it's a reasonable request and this person has it and you're willing to exchange something for it, you should ask for it. If it's money and you have a thing, fine. If it's a thing and you have money, fine. If you do that, you just might find people not only saying yes, but you getting what you want. You see what I'm saying? And this is not you're going to go get a job selling computer hardware. This is getting through your life and building a life of acquiring what you want. Because a lot of times what you want isn't a thing or isn't money. It's time. It's space. When you tell your husband, women, I want to spend more time together, you're selling. Treat it like that. Explain, what does that mean? What does that mean? I want to spend more time together. You think that means anything? It doesn't mean anything. Because I have no idea what that means. Right? What does that mean? Does that mean you just want me to not work as much? And we're going to sit on the couch? Or does that mean you want to go out on a date night once a week? Or does that mean that we should take two walks a week in the park? What does that mean? Sell the concept. Sell the idea. You might be surprised how quickly your man goes, oh, I didn't know you wanted to do that. Let's go do that shit right now. I think sometimes the other side of it is that people are afraid to get a yes, and they don't really want what they think they want. So you have to clearly define what you want so that when you transfer the belief that it's a good idea, you believe it too. You see, the problem with the transfer of belief definition as an absolute definition is it's absolutely correct. Thou may not transfer a belief thouest does not possess. You can't transfer what you don't have. There's another saying in sales. There's two things I can never sell to. And the traditionals, I've added a word to it. It's ignorance and poverty. I can't sell to ignorance and I can't sell to poverty. I've changed it to willful ignorance because ignorance can be cured. So if somebody just doesn't want their ignorance cured, I can't sell to that. And I can't sell to poverty. If I'm selling Lamborghinis, I can't sell it to somebody that makes $14,000 a year. Doesn't matter how much I believe that he would look good in that car, he can't afford it, right? So you can't sell to somebody that's impoverished. Well, you can't sell to somebody if you are an impoverished believer in the thing that you're selling. And I've seen it. I've seen salespeople lose faith in the company that they work for, and their numbers just tank. They're doing everything the same. They're making the same number of calls. They're making the same number of appointments. They're doing everything they're supposed to be. But they lost faith. And when they lost faith, they no longer had anything to transfer. And the only people they sell to are the laydowns. Laydowns are the people they were gonna, like, the only way you blow a laydown sell is you fuck it up. You talk too much, you did too much. There are, like, when you sell, this is a way to divide it in your head. It'll never be exactly, but it's basically one third of your sales. Unless you break it, they're gonna buy from you. This, you're answering the phone, hey, I want this, okay. That's $1,000 a piece, and that's $10,000 plus tax. Okay, when can I get it? I'll send a PO in. That's a third of your sales. A third of your sales are people that you are going to push over the buying ledge. They were going to say no, but you did your job well, and they said yes, right? So about half is going to be laydowns, and half of the completed sales, a third each, right? But a half of what you close is going to be either they were going to buy anyway or you made it happen. And a third are your nevers. We'll talk in a minute about getting rid of those as quickly as possible, right? And CEO Foothill says not everything is transactional. Depends on how you define transactional, doesn't it? Everything between two people is transactional, and I defy you to prove otherwise. And I'm going to say that part of transactional relationships is time commitments. So no matter what you want, right, then you are going to have some level of my time required, if not my money, my possessions, my things. My podcast is transactional every day. I ask you to listen to me, and I have to do a good enough job that you think I'm worth your time. Even if you never pay me a dime, you never buy from my sponsors, you never buy from my links, the attention versus the discussion is transactional. I'm putting out effort, and you're choosing to take value from it. Everything that is between multiple parties on some level is transactional. It just doesn't necessarily mean money or stuff. And if you want to try to give me another explanation for that, I would love it, because that's a good challenge. I just don't agree. All right. If you debate somebody you're selling, I just sold an idea. Colorado Foothills brought up a buyer's question. Objections are buying questions. I don't see how that will benefit me. Well, this is how it will benefit you, right? Well, that's also a form of debate. I think this is the best way to do a thing. I disagree. I think option B is better, and here is why. So let's say you have a job. You never sell, but you have to work on teams. You have projects. You're not even the project manager. You're a member of a team. The project manager has an idea. His idea is stupid. It is not going to work. It is going to fuck everything up. It's going to cost the company money. His boss, and hence your boss's boss, are going to be pissed about it, and they don't like it. So there's a couple ways you can handle that. There's really about three, and any version of what you'll come up with will follow one of these three. You shut up and you go along. You let him take the hit. It's his fucking problem. I don't care. Right? It could still hurt you, right? Colorado Foothill says love, particularly parental lot love. I don't believe it should be transactional, but it is, whether you believe it or not. Tell me, when you hug your child, there's not a transaction of affection that goes back and forth. Transactional does not mean bad or negative or conditional. It just means that it is an exchange. Anyway, we'll keep moving. Yeah, when you debate somebody, you're selling your idea. So one thing is to just let it go. It's not my problem. He's the boss. Let him take the hit. But the whole team looks bad, so that's probably not good for you. Number two is you tell them exactly what you think with no selling. That idea is stupid, Frank, and it's going to get us all fired. He's probably going to tell you to shut up, put your hate back where you were, and he'll actually get more entrenched in that idea. Or you can effectively say, Frank, I have an idea, and I wonder if you would be interested in hearing it. Now, Frank's sitting at the head of the table. There's all these people he has on his team, either because they were assigned, or more likely he had some say in having them there. Is he going to say no? You made it very easy to say no, but that actually makes it really hard to say no. Right? That's one of my rules for my system here. We'll get to in a minute. But so Frank says, sure. Now he's giving you permission. See, this is how selling works. You gain permission from the other side to express your view or your value. So you say, Frank, I think that maybe if we took this approach, and then you lay out your approach, and you say, and I'm really interested in what you think about that and what everybody else here on the team thinks about it. And then what do? That is a intermediate close. You're not asking for the final deal, but you've reached a point in the deal where to go forward will require some level of consensus. So what have I already taught you to do? Shut up. Shut up. Listen to everybody. And one of the really effective techniques of being a good salesperson is recognizing interpersonal energy flow. You should write that shit down. Interpersonal energy flow. You know, there's like the old game where they have like people around the fire and everybody's discussing something and they have the talking stick, right? We pass the talking stick around. You only talk if you have the stick. This is for babies. This is for people that don't understand when it's their turn to talk. You've done that. You've dumped and you asked a question of anybody in that room that has an idea about it. Let it go. When somebody says something you think is equally stupid to Frank's original idea, let it be said. Let it be heard. Let it be debated. What will happen, and it will happen almost every time, is that after everybody kind of dumps and gets what they have in them about this idea out, all the eyes will just turn to you, even though you're not in charge. Ask me how I know. At that point, you should have been keeping notes. If you're like me and you can do it in your head, fine. If not, and what I do with notes, I'll write down single words, just like that's really important. Like I'll write down Tom. I don't even need to write what he said. I just know I need to remember what Tom said, right? And then I'll expand from there. And then when you expand from there, if like you have to be open to the fact that your idea might not have been very good. It might have just been shot down. And your response might be, you know what, you guys are right. That's really not a good idea. Thank you for helping me with that. See? Right? But you might get somebody go, but there was one piece of that. And then Frank picks it up if he's good at what he does and it starts getting incorporated and you come to a better deal together. See, sales isn't always just getting what you want. It's getting what everybody wants. It's making deals. This is how you negotiate. This is how you end up when Frank goes away with his job. But you're not in sales, so you don't need to know any of this shit. You're happy making 40 grand a year, right? Which you could make at Walmart saying, here's your shopping cart. Or you want to advance. It's up to you. But when you learn to do this, you have a leg up on everybody in society because they've all been beaten down just like you were. But they never fixed it. They never fixed it, right? I'm going to give you the most basic sales formula that I've ever come across. It's deadly effective. It works really great, especially like selling consumer price goods. But children are experts at it, okay? Create, agitate, solve, help. This is a textbook sales formula. This is actually taught in like sales books, sales training programs, even programs that go way beyond it, teach it as a foundation. Some of like the most well-known, most expensive sales training in the world is going to give you this exact technique I'm about to hand you right here. Create, agitate, solve, help. Create a problem. Create a problem. Now, creating a problem doesn't always mean you actually cause the problem to occur. Because that's to fit in an acronym. Has anybody figured out the anacronym yet? Create, agitate, solve, help.
All right.
Create means that the problem probably already exists, but you make the prospect aware of the problem. The buttons on this thing don't do what you want them to do. This little homemade seed planter doesn't quite work as well as the better one that I have that's automated, right? You create the problem by bringing it up to the person that you're talking to. Frank, I think that idea has merit, but I have a different idea. The presentation of the idea alone in that scenario I gave you is the creation of a problem. By showing a better idea or an idea with promise that seems better, it shows the problem with the original idea. So, in other words, it's not the best idea for the situation. So you've created the problem. Well, now the next step is you let that person sit with it. So you presented your solution to Frank, and now you shut your effing hole. You let Frank talk and anybody else in the discussion speak until they're kind of out of ideas. And if they haven't shot you down to a point where you yourself know that's a bad idea, you agitate the problem. So you bring up more good. See, you can agitate without pointing out the negative. You might point out the negative. Well, if we took that approach, Sue, it's likely that we would actually cannibalize our own sales. If we bring this product to market too soon, we're going to disrupt sales of an existing product. We should probably clear out inventory before we do that. That's a direct agitation. You've pointed out the flaw in Sue's idea, and therefore you've made yours more attractive. But you could just simply say, you know what? I think if we take this approach over here, we're going to have a higher revenue for the whole year if we push it until the third quarter, and here's why. I don't actually have to attack Sue to agitate. I might, but I'm going to be careful about it. It depends. How important is it for me to kill this before I can go to that? If I don't need to kill it, then I'm going to leave it alone because people don't like having their shit pushed back on them. They don't want to feel, because, you know, Sue might feel personally attacked. Where I'm not attacking Sue, I'm attacking Sue's idea. So the more I focus on my positive outcome and the less on the negative outcome that could come from Sue or Debbie or Frank or Tom or Sam, doesn't matter who, right? The more I'm actually agitating to the positive. But one way or another, I'll agitate the problem. Consumer electronics. Guy comes in, he's looking at a TV. I worked in an electronics shop because I lost my, you know, lost my podcast, and that's what I have to do now. Looking for a TV? Yeah. Okay. What do you have now? And they start describing it. Get them to talk. You can agitate the problem with their words. If you ask the right probing questions, they'll start explaining to you what they don't like about their existing TV. It's not big enough, right? It's getting a little glitchy. They've gotten so inexpensive now, I can't see not getting, whatever it is, agitate it, right? Then you solve the problem. Well, if we take this solution and install it, here's all the good things that will occur because of it. Yeah? Has anybody figured this out yet, where this is going to go, right? Colorado Food says, isn't this exactly what the government does? No, the government does something totally different because the government lies. You notice I haven't said the lie or deceive in any way yet. Right? That's the difference. Right? When they create the problem, they actually stir up a problem. I'm actually looking for an actual problem because I use ethics-based sales. So if you don't need a new TV, if it's not in your best interest, I don't want to sell you one. There's plenty of other people to sell a TV to. Where the government wants you to have the TV paid for by somebody else, and they want you to hate the person that paid for it. So it's not the same thing at all. Quit trying to finagle around this because you're uncomfortable. Because all that's happening here, this person, who I really don't know well, I don't recognize you from other episodes, but you're disturbed by the terminology because your programming is reaching up and trying to pull you away from what you're hearing. That's what's happening. You're hearing transactional, and that must be conditional. Is there anything conditional upon you listening to this podcast? It's still transactional, right? When you hear create a problem, instead of hearing a sales training technique, which is what it is, you're hearing actually go out and professionally agitate somebody who wants to be left alone. Not what I'm saying. So we've solved the problem by presenting the solution. Now there's only one thing left to do. Help the person take and get the solution. If you're selling a thing and they don't have enough money up front, we do have financing. 0% for 18 months. This is what your payment monthly would be on that, with no interest whatsoever and zero down payment. What do you do after you give that number to somebody in that that is transactional, right? What do you do? Now, Legacy says read. If you are the person on the other end of the deal, I do recommend you read. I absolutely recommend you read what was handed to you. All of it. Okay? Like when you miss one payment by one day, it goes double, or the interest rate goes to 90% or something. I recommend that. If you're the salesperson, once you hand that person that piece of paper with that number on it, what do you do? Shut up. You've helped. Help is closed. Notice it's the last one, create, agitate, solve, help. So help is closed. So when you close, you shut up. You shut up. You wait. You let them read. If they take 15 minutes to read the whole thing, pick up your phone and catch up on some text messages. Give them their space. Let them have all the time in the world. They will eventually go, well, and then whatever they need, and you will continue to help them until you realize the deal's not going to happen and you end it, or the deal happens. But every time that you present them with an option, shut up. Shut up, because I've watched salespeople talk themselves out of deals. I've watched them talk themselves out of like a $50 a month cell phone contract, and I've watched them talk themselves out of $1.5 million data center install because they didn't know when to shut up. And this is including, would you like to go on a date Thursday? Shut up. It's incredibly effective because whatever the reason for no is, if you shut up, the other party will tell you what it is. And then you can make a determination. I can help them get past this, or that's a legitimate reason that I'm not going to get through today, so I'm going to say farewell. I'm going to say, well, if you change your mind, here's my card. I'm going to say, hey, can I at least add you to my email list? Whatever the right thing to do at that point is, and you're going to end it. And you want to work through that process as quickly as possible. But what's the acronym? If you master this skill as a salesperson, what is the acronym? What does it spell? Create, agitate, solve, help, cash. It's literally the cash formula. Salespeople that now this is like Othello, right? A minute to learn, a lifetime to master. But when you master that skill, you're able to effectively sell. Effective selling doesn't mean you close every deal because you have to be unethical to close every deal. You have to lie to close every deal. When I end the show today, I'm going to present to you an electric sausage stuffer that's $500. It's awesome. If you want to make sausage in large volume, you should get one. If you want to start making sausage, buy a cheaper one. I have those options too. If you don't have any interest in doing this, you should not buy it. Right? So if you are an ethical salesperson, you are not going to close every deal. What you're going to do is close the majority of deals that are closable, whether it is getting a date, whether it is going to a school, whether it is getting a promotion or a raise, or whether it is actually selling a thing to somebody. This is not hard. They've made it hard. You know how to do this. You want to know this formula? My niece, who now has a degree from A&M and is working as a zookeeper, when she was little, I mean like 6 years old, little, she was going to her grandma's house. Grandma's a pushover. Meyer clears all the shit out of her little play purse so that when she gets to grandma, she can tell her there's nothing in her purse to play with and talks grandma, I'm going to abbreviate this, but talks grandma into going to the store, like the dollar store, and spending like $5-6 on stuff so when they get home they can play. Perfectly executed. Created the problem, agitated the problem, solved the problem, and helped grandma decide to go to the dollar store. Right? Innately, we know how to do this. And you know what her parents said? Oh, Meyer, that's manipulative. No, it's brilliant. Grandma's a grown-ass woman. She can say no anytime she wants to. $5-6 is not going to change your life. This particular grandma spends time at the Indian casinos anyway. It's better she spend it there than at the Indian casino in a slot machine with one pull and it's gone. Why beat that out of a child? The child has executed a formula that is in the highest level sales training perfectly at 6, and you want them to not do it. Gee, why can't kids do anything? Why can't kids get a start? Why can't they pull themselves up by their bootstraps? Maybe if we stop cutting their fucking bootstraps off, they'll be able to pull themselves up by them. I know this is not what some people want to hear today. It's a very powerful, assertive message. But just because you don't like it doesn't mean it's not true. It's how the world runs. And we don't have to be cutthroat, and we really shouldn't be unethical in doing this. Right? We just have to do the right thing at the right time and learn to shut up. Next, the best way to get to a yes, I already hit this a little bit, is to make it easy to say no. If you make it hard to say no, you're going to get a lot of no's. You make people uncomfortable when you make it hard to say no. When you make people uncomfortable, you do what Disney's done. They hired writers who wanted to make white young males uncomfortable with Star Wars, and they ruined arguably the most successful movie franchise in history. They can't get 18-year-old kids to watch a series with lesbian space witches in it. Think about that. How bad did you screw that up? When I was an 18-year-old kid, if you said there's a Star Wars with lesbian space witches, really? 16, oh my God, right? You know, 15, 16, like you're still trying to find the Playboy that your buddy stole, right? Like, lesbian space witches and Star Wars? Oh, look, and then you watch it go, no, this sucks, right? That's because you didn't do the right thing. You tried to make people uncomfortable, and when you make people uncomfortable, they reject you. Here's another analogy for that. You're driving along in your car. You look on the side of the road, there's a stray dog. It's kind of scared. You get out of the car and you think, I know, I'm going to save this dog's existence. So the dog is terrified of you. You grab the dog, you hold his mouth shut, you put him in the back of the car, and you take him home. You put him in a small room, you get a bowl of food, and you go shove it in his face till he's backed up in a corner shivering. What's going to happen to you? What is that dog most likely going to do to you? He's going to bite the piss out of you, and you deserved it. I was only trying to help, but what did you do? You made it hard for the dog to say no. What if you got out of the car, had a little bit of food on you, laid it on the ground and walked away, and the dog came and ate the food? And eventually you're able to get a leash on the dog and you take the dog home. And when you get the dog home, you give the dog space where it can move around and feel unrestricted. And you put some more food down in a bowl of water. And then you sit a little bit away from the food and water. And the dog comes up and eats the food and water. And you sit there and you do not put yourself on the dog. You just sit there with your hand where the dog can get to your hand before your body. Don't be surprised when that dog comes up and smells your hand. And when with no movement of your body, you reach up and just pet him on the back of his head. Don't be surprised if in a day or two, that dog is completely loyal and devoted to you. Why? You made it easy to say no. You have to make it easy for whoever you're asking anything to say no, or they're uncomfortable. If you make it easy to say no, they'll say no when the fit's wrong. Or they're not sure about the fit, they'll tell you. Again, those are objections and buying questions. But how, but why, but what if? Then you have an opportunity to carry the conversation forward. Or they'll say yes. There's the only three outcomes you'll get. No, additional information is required, or yes. And when you get a yes, what do? You close the deal. The signature, if you're asking for a date, how about the movie, the Christmas movie with the giant guy in it, Elf, right? When he asks the girl out, the girl that plays the elf in the Santa thing at the store, and his little brother, like the teenage kid, is with him, and she says yes, and he tries to talk. He's like, he just grabs him and jerks him away. You have a time. You have a place. You're done. I'll see you Thursday. Right? When they sign the contract, I will make sure that everything goes through. Is there anything else I can answer for you right now? Nope. Bye-bye. Right? We are proud to welcome you to Harvard University. Thank you, Dean. Goodbye. You've executed the end of the contract unless there is something necessary. Go away. And then follow up as agreed. This is ethical sales, right? That most of you are unfamiliar with, because if I say salesman, you probably, again, think of a guy in sharkskin shoes selling used cars with like a porn stash from the 70s or something. Or Herb Tarlick from WKRP in Cincinnati would be a perfect archetype of what people would think of. That is not how it works. Not how it works when you're successful. Next, never leave money on the table. That's something I drilled into my people. Never leave money on the table. Money is really opportunity. Never, and it can be in many forms that we don't think of as selling. Let's say you decided to have a little farm business. And you wanted your farm business to actually be a significant portion of income. Like, my farm business is, can we sell enough eggs that I don't pay for food? That's it. That's all I want out of it. I get the ducks. I get all of their intrinsic characteristics and all the benefit that I get from them on the property. I get to eat food that comes from the ducks. We sell the surplus and everything's paid for. I'm good. That's all I want. You actually want to make an income, though. So you emulate me. You create a duck farm like I have. Much bigger. Like it used to be when we actually were making money. And you want this to be something that actually is a going concern. It's not just a side hustle. You want it to grow. You develop a customer base. That customer base clearly is concerned about high-quality food, and they're clearly willing to pay more than they will at the supermarket for it. What do? I'll get more ducks. Wrong answer. I mean, if you can't meet your orders, you should get more ducks. But what you should do is say, what's the opportunity? Well, maybe microgreens fits this opportunity. Now, all you already have a customer base, that is not leaving an opportunity, i.e. money on the table, right? when you ask for a raise, and I know I said when you get the clothes, shut up, but when the raise is ridiculously low, there is a place to push back. Well, Bill, I appreciate the confidence you've shown in me by offering me a 2% raise. But I think given my market value, I'm going to have to consider other options now. Are you leaving? I'm not saying that. I'm just saying I'm going to have to think about this. Right? That's a pushback. I'm not going to leave money on the table. I know Bill's willing to give me more than 2%. I know without even going to his boss, like anybody in that position can do better than that. We're not talking. We're not even keeping up with inflation, Bill. Right? Anything that you can follow up with Stack at, when you go to a website and you want, I want to buy this widget, and you're checking out, it says people that bought this widget also bought that widget. You might not want it, but the fact that it's there means you might take it. They're using automation to not leave money on the table. When you go to the store and you get your few things and you're standing in line and the magazines and the candy and the beef jerky's all there in the front, they're not leaving money on the table. They don't hate money. They're saying, have you considered these other items that we know are impulse buys? I'll just put them where you are. Nobody comes out and says, hey, do you want this? But they did. It's called merchandising. It's another form of sales. The way you arrange things, the order they're arranged in, how high they are, the shit the kids want, I'm going to put that shit about three foot off the ground where the kids see it, where they can look at it. When mom's like looking around here, the kid can see it. Mommy, I want this. I want the kids sell for me. Like, don't leave money on the table. All right? You also only promise what you can deliver. Do not tell somebody you have a lifetime warranty if you know that you do not. It would be a real obvious example. If you're not sure when the thing can be given to them, like there's inventory issues, be honest. Look, we're low on inventory right now. Even if you say you want it and we do the deal today, I don't know when we're going to be able to deliver the product. My best guess is within 15 days, it could be as late as 30. And if I'm saying that, it's probably that I can get the product somewhere between 10 and 20 days. I'm going to under-promise and over-deliver. That way I'm putting buffer in because the person above me could be bullshitting me. They could be bullshitting me. And we're going to have to turn that around into a stronger close. When I worked for Fluke, they came out with this product called OptiFiber. They were like the base model was 20,000 and up. Like the way we sold them, they were usually about $35,000. And we would usually sell them in pairs because there was an advantage to having two. And so that's a $70,000 order for one item. But when they first put them in the inventory, we only had like 50 in the whole company. And the company got mad at me because I sold like half of them in 2 days. Do you know how I sold them? I went out and told people the truth. I said, they only have 50 in inventory. I don't know how long it's going to take to get them, but if we get an order from you, POs put you in order, like the order the POs come in is when they're delivered. So even if they all sell, like your PO in means the first one that's available of the next run will be yours. Some people would say that's high pressure, but it was the truth. If you actually want this thing in any reasonable amount of time, this is how you get it. That was helping. And they did. They got mad at me because I sold like half the inventory in 2 days. I'm like, I thought you wanted, like you gave me the quota. I'm trying to make it so I don't, you know. I ended up not working for that company eventually, and it was somewhat mutual in that decision. Close all the loops yourself. Like if there is a place in the deal that failure can occur, let's say you pitch something over to like an engineering department, right? You pitch somebody over to an engineering department, and your engineering department is not necessarily going to view the priority of that deal at the level that you do. Well, then you contact engineering. And when you contact engineering and you do it politely and with ethics and you do it in a way that doesn't embarrass anybody, but you CC your customer. Bill, we just got an order in from Teledyne Systems and they're really looking forward to what engineering will be able to put together for them. When can we expect your first pass on this arrangement? If you do not get an answer, and you're going to follow up. And there's times where you're going to follow up without the customer seeing it, but you're going to close the loop. You're going to make damn sure that your guy stays at the top of the stack because that's part of your job. Your job is just to flip the order and go on about your business. Now, you figure out how that applies to everything else in your life. when you, and again, everything we do is selling and networking and building a network. I want to build a community. I don't want a network. Well, I don't think you understand the meaning of the word network then. A community is a network. A group of computers connected by wireless or cable is a network. A group of humans connected by an idea is a network of humans. So when you have somebody in that network and you've done something with them, you need to follow up with that and you need to close the loop. Make sure that they're happy. Like, it amazes me that salespeople will close a deal, okay? They'll close a deal, and then the customer spends the money with them, and then they go on to the next deal, and they never contact that customer again. Well, they already bought, and I sell a one-off thing. Do they have friends? Do they have family? Are they potentially a source of referrals? What if they're unhappy? I mean, I would say, you know, set a frequency depending on the product and the situation, like that they would be having it long enough to use it long enough to have determined how they feel about it. So that could be 2 weeks, it could be 2 months, it could be 2 days. There should be a follow-up. Hey, this is Jack from Tell Diner or wherever, and yeah, me, right? I just want to know, is everything good? And sometimes they're like, well, I don't need anything else. I don't have anything else. That's actually a great situation to be in. There's nothing else for me to really give you. I just want to know if you're happy. Are you happy with it? Is there any? Do you need any support? Like, do you need our technical support? Have you had to reach out for anything? Is there anything you need? Is there anything I can do for you? No? Great. Off the phone. Off the phone. And that one, that's not an email. That's not a text message. That is, I don't care if you never spoke to that person except the day you made the deal. That is, you pick the phone up and you speak to them. And if they don't answer, then a voicemail is appropriate. And you leave that very voicemail. I'm just checking up to make sure everything's good. If you could let me know. And they can answer you by text, by ignoring you, whatever. You just need to deliver that message if there's anything else you need. Because what's going to happen is Bill's going to be talking to Tom, and Tom's going to be, I need one of those. Oh, let me introduce you to my guy. Now you're a valuable asset to them. He's great. Well, what did he do? He took my money, and then he asked me if I was happy. He's not going to say it that way, but that's what you did. And that is in all things. When you treat your professor in college that way, and you're trying to get your first job, and you ask that professor for a letter of recommendation, you're going to get a stellar one. You are going to get a stellar recommendation. I want you to understand these things go across the broad spectrum of getting everything that you want in life. All right. And again, and Santos is saying STFU. And that's funny. That was my next bullet point. Ask what you want and then shut up. Shut up. Somebody asked about the shirt I'm wearing today. SOE Tactical Gear, John Willis, Speed, Surprise, Violence of Action. I don't think these are in stock anymore, though, but he's always got cool stuff over there at SOE Tactical Gear. All right. So here's my system in a nutshell, my keys to success. First, spend 80% of your time on the best prospects that you have. So if you work 100 hours, 80 hours should have been in some way touching the prospects that you've uncovered for what you're trying to accomplish that are the most likely to convert. And spend 20% of your time looking for new prospects and sorting them. It's an 80-20 rule in reverse. That's what you do. Because when you initially make contact, cold call, if you want to call it that, you're going to immediately develop a perception. And there's three buckets that person can go into. Probably, possibly, and never. That's it. And nevers can become possibles or probables in the future, but the distant future. You're selling end-of-life services. You got a lead. You called the guy up. Turns out he's 22 years old, no kids, no wife. And his parents have a $100,000 life insurance policy on him. So he knows he can go in the ground. Not my problem. Like, that's a never. For the purpose of my sales cycle, not in it. Not in it this year, not in it next year, out, right? If they want to subscribe to some sort of newsletter or something that puts them in a long-term funnel, great. But overall, I want to filter that guy. I like, just not my guy. I'm not going to be rude. I'm going to be like, Bill, you're an idiot. I hate you. Go away. It's going to be like, Bill, I don't think you're in a place right now where you need to worry about this, but if anything comes up, let me know. Get off the phone. Or end the conversation, however it's going, quickly and swiftly. Take as little of the prospect's time as you can to convey the information you have. When you're selling, the number one thing you are competing for isn't money, it's time. When I ran a company, if somebody wanted to talk to me, I had a personal assistant. Her name was Allison. She was really good at telling people nicely to go fuck off. She knew when to let somebody through to speak to me. She knew, like, Jack might be interested in this. And she'd say, hold. She wouldn't promise to put them through to me because she's going to check and see if she can. And she would explain to me what the basics were. And my response would be, not interested. Never mad at her. Just tell them to go away. Put them through. I'm going to let it go to voicemail. And when I said I was going to do voicemail, she would tell them, Mr. Spiegel's not available. He said it's fair for you to leave him a voicemail, though. Would you like to do that? I can put you through. And then usually they would. And then they would get me on the phone. You know what I'm thinking? I don't know. What day is it? What the fuck are my problems? What's going on? I got 50 people in that room that work for me. I got 2,500 contractors spread all over the world. Like, I got some stuff to think about. So if you're going to sell me something, you better get to the point quick. And if they did, and I thought it was useful, and they had a next step that was reasonable, I would take the next step with them. Doesn't mean I'm going to buy, but if it, can I send some information to you? If I'm not going to read it, I just tell them no. And the person that could get on the phone and off the phone with me in 2 minutes was way more likely to close the deal than to someone that held me on that phone for 10 minutes trying to get to a yes right away. Because, and then I'll tell you the other thing, the guy that took 10 minutes of my time for me to finally tell him, listen, man, get the fuck off my phone. If he calls back, you get, I call it tell him I died syndrome. It's a disease. Mr. Spirico, Bill from Exxon is on the phone. Tell Bill I'm dead. And I literally, like, I'm not kidding. And Mr. Spirico's dead. Click. Dead to you. But when you respect my time and you call back, well, the last time this guy called, he was very respectful of my time. I'll take a 2-minute phone call with him. And when he asks for an appointment, I know I'm dealing with somebody that's business oriented, that's not going to waste my time. And if there's enough interest there to take a meeting, I'll take the meeting because I know I'm not going to end up with an hour and a half of my time taken and not really learn anything. But if you waste my time, I am done. I am done. I don't want anything to do. Tell them I died. So on and off as quick as possible, right? And tell your prospect why you chose them. You're asking for a date? I think we'd get along. You're really pretty. You're a woman, you're really handsome, whatever, right? Like, why did you ask? Why are you asking? I'm calling you today because I've worked with your competitors. They had a similar problem to what I see you're working through right now. I was looking at the news, I was looking at your website, whatever, and I see that you're currently trying to do X, Y, and Z. I think we have a solution that may enable us to help you with that. Could I tell you about it? Shut up. You know what they're probably going to say? Okay, go ahead. And what they're thinking is, what kind of bullshit is this? You better have a really good 30-second to 60-second answer. And it better not go anywhere except to the point. And if you do that, you're probably going to get a follow-up of some kind. It really is that simple. If you tell them why you're contacting them, I'm contacting you because it's my job, is not an answer, right? I'm asking you on a date because I don't have one is not an answer. What about the person, the company, the prospect, the individual specifically that made you decide to contact them? Unless you're sitting with a headset on your phone and computer auto-dialing for you, you made the decision to contact them. You should tell them why. Even in that call center scenario, there's probably a way that they're targeted. You should tell them what it is. It's probably in that environment, it's probably in a script in front of you. Like, this is something a monkey could do if he could talk. Follow the script. I've seen call centers, like, the person who just literally memorizes the script, memorizes all the answers, is a great salesperson. And they can be a freaking, like, functionally almost tarded, right, and still be a great, because they just follow the system that was developed, right? When you're out in the real world instead of in that condensed environment, you don't have that formula. You have to build it for yourself, right? And be direct about why you're contacting them. Don't beat around the bush. Don't ask them about their family. They don't know you, right? That's stupid. If you start, hey, did you notice today that the weather was this way? I'm click. I'll tell you, that's how I was. Like, as soon as we're not talking about the thing that we should be talking about, I am ending the conversation because my time is valuable and I don't have time for this shit. Right? And people do this, again, outside of what we think of as sales. You ask a girl out and you start blathering on about nonsense. Unless she finds you cute and charming because of it, she's going to say no. We have a class together, and I heard the way you answered a question yesterday. I was thinking the same thing. And it just made me think that maybe it'd be worth going out on a date. She says, no, I don't care. Because I'm going to go use that same line on some other chick. Right? As long as it's somebody I actually wanted to go out with. You get enough no's, you get enough yeses. That's how, and it doesn't matter. You're trying to get into school, apply to all of the good ones. Take the same approach with all of them and then pick and choose from the ones that say yes. You're trying to get a job, apply to all the ones that make sense. Get as many interviews as you can. Do the same thing in every interview, but tailor it to the individual, right? And then take from all the yeses the one that works best for you. You don't think this works on the front end of getting a job? Bill, I'm calling you today because I understand that you're the hiring manager for XYZ Corporation. Right there, Bill thinks you're a recruiter. He thinks you're going to try to sell him a candidate. You are, but not the way he thinks. Well, yeah, you know, we're not really hiring. Yeah, I know that you're not exactly hiring right now, but I have a candidate I'd like to tell you about. And then sell the candidate. And then tell Bill, and you're speaking to him. I am very interested in working with you, Bill. I'm contacting you because I learned this about your company, and I think I can be helpful to your company in this manner. Let me tell you something about people that do that. Companies that say they're not hiring are lying. Every company is always hiring, including we have this deadbeat pain in the ass that I'm only keeping here because I need somebody in that position. Does anybody out here that's ever worked for a company with more than, let's say, 10 people in it not know the one person that I'm talking about? I think anything that gets up to 10 or more, you have at least one of them. At my wife's old office, her name was Edna, and we refer to them as the Ednas. When we go into office environments or whatever, where we're the customer, we have to deal with people. My wife's like, which one's the Edna? I'm like, that one. She's like, yeah, that's me too, right? Like, we can spot them instantly now because I need it. So every company that's more than 10 people has one. If you're good enough, they'll fire Edna and give you Edna's job. Right? Every company's always hiring. If I come into a company and the guy there I'm talking to has the authority to hire me, and if he doesn't, I need to get above him. This is sales. If I'm getting to a level where the guy's telling me no, but I know he doesn't have the authority to say yes, I got to get over him. No means I don't have time for you and I can't say yes anyway, so go away and leave me alone. Great. Who do you work for? Right? So you go in with that attitude. I guarantee you, if you approach 10 companies that way, you're getting 5 interviews. Probably without a resume. The last job I had, I gave the person in HR the resume after I got the offer letter so they had one to put in a file. I'm not kidding. This is how you get what you want in life. And by the way, that would be a survival topic. Imagine having this skill set in an economy in shambles. How much better off would you be if you had it versus not having it? Make it clear nicely that you do not need them. You never want to be in a negotiation, a prospecting situation where the person feels like they need me. That reeks of desperation, and the best place to see that is in dating. You go up to a woman and you tell her, I fell in love with you the first time I saw you and I have got to go out with you. I mean, unless you're like golden ratio, male model looking shit or something like that, and she thinks it's being playful and whatever, and just a line, they're going to get it. If they believe that you're really saying it and you really mean it that way, right? And I'd say it's the other way too. Like a girl coming on and you like that, you're like, no. No, this is a bunny boiler, right? I don't need a bunny boiler in my life, right? But if it's like, hey, I was wondering if you'd like to go out, I'm free on Thursday. Well, that actually sounds like, and I don't really give a fuck if you say no. And that's where you have to be, but you have to be nice about it. when you're prospecting somebody for sales, and let's say technology, so I'm going to be in town next week, and I have Wednesday and Thursday, I have some open slots. Would you be interested in meeting them, since I'm going to be in town then? And I'm filling my schedule out right now. And based on our last conversation, I thought that I should ask you first. Does that sound like you need them? Does that sound like you need them? No. You're asking for a job. They give you an initial offer. You don't really like the number. I'm entertaining several offers right now. I'll have to take this under consideration. I really like your company. I really like the opportunity here, but I'm not really sure about the pay. In fact, I'm wondering, like, am I missing something? Is there some sort, something built into the benefits or something that I'm missing? Shut up. It's always back to when you get the, when you've clearly delivered the idea that you intended to deliver, shut up and let them talk. Right? That's how you handle that, right? I have three appointments left available. Would you like one of them? Not, I'm coming to town and I'm bored. I got nothing to do when I get there. I got one sales, even if it's true, I got one sales call and my boss is up my ass to have, you know, five booked on that day. Will you help me out? That's not good, right? Know your cycle and stick to it. Know your cycle and stick to it. So, and your cycle will change based on what you're doing. So like I review and recommend products and my rep from Vivor said, well, nobody bought one of those sausage stuffers yesterday. It's a $500 product. People think about it. I don't post and ghost. That's exactly what I told her in an email that I sent this morning. I don't post and ghost. I'm not some TikToker that's going to push this thing once. It goes into my catalog long term. This is an investment that people will make over time. They'll buy it when they're ready. They'll probably buy a lot more of them in the fall than they will right now as we get into, you know, processing season, hunting season, getting ready for winter, getting ready for like all that stuff. Like that's when people really think more that way. I wanted to get it out in advance. But when you put up a product that's $50, people buy it a lot faster. So your cycle, you need to know. And you need to respect that cycle. But your cycle is also like, I put a person into a funnel and then these steps happen. And this is where they either come out the bottom of the funnel as buyers or they're ejected as nevers. And you stick to that cycle. If your cycle is, when I first went into sales, I was in data cabling. 8 o'clock in the morning till 10 o'clock in the morning, I cold called on the phone. Every company I could find in Dallas-Fort Worth with enough employees to have a data network, I called. And for 2 hours, I did nothing but call. I shut my door and I locked my office door. And when my boss asked me about it, I told him what I was doing. I said, I do not have time to be disturbed. This is for this. And the rest of the day, I went and did calls in the floor. I actually went and met with people. I did walkthroughs. I worked on my estimates. I followed up on it, but for those first 2 hours, I called because I hated it. I hate cold calling. I hate calling people on the phone who don't know me to ask them if they would like more information about what I am doing and being told 9 out of 10 times to go fuck myself. It's no fun. But if you're told 9 out of 10 times to go fuck yourself and you make 100 calls in a day, what do you end up with? 10 qualified prospects. And that was my cycle. And if I had 9, I went out and had a little thing like when you can come in on the door, and I just move it 15 minutes, assuming that I didn't have something else that had to be done. Really simple. Really simple. Know your cycle and stick to it. And remember, it's a funnel. The more in, the more out. That's how simple this is. You're a young man looking for a woman to spend your life with, prospect your ass off. And as soon as you know it's a negative, cut bait, get out, done, finished, no. Women, same. There's an old saying, and I think this is a big part of why we have so many miserable people in their 40s that do not have a life partner and don't have any kids. And I'm not saying you have to have kids, I'm just saying I think that's part of the issue. Right? People hang on to situations they shouldn't hang on to, and they don't seek enough until they find one that really makes sense. And women are worse about it today than men. Women are all about, you know, all this stupid shit you see on TikTok. Well, he has to make $500,000 a year. Bitch, you are not worth $50,000 a year. If that's the way you're coming at this. I don't care if you're pretty. I don't care what. Like, who are you as a person? That's what a guy cares about if he's looking for somebody to be with long term. But there's an old saying. She pursued him until he caught her. She pursued him until he caught her. I'm going to let that one sit. You guys figure out what that means, right? But it's all back to transfer of belief. And you can't transfer what you don't have. So let's not take this to, I'm selling you computer test equipment, which I used to do. And let's go to the dating thing. The guy that doesn't value himself enough, right? Or the person that values himself way too much will have a hard time finding women to date who are worth dating. Now, if he's a really good looking guy and he's got a bunch of money or something and he wants to be a sleaze, he may run through a lot of women. But finding somebody really worth it who values him equally is going to be very, very difficult. But a person that believes that they have something to offer, they believe in who and what they are. They're not letting self-doubt run their life. They're also humble enough to know where they fall short, and they work on what they fall short on daily, and they accentuate that which they do well to compensate for it, and believes in themselves. When they make that prospective inquiry, they're going to do it with confidence. Nothing sells an idea, a person, a thing, a product, money, a deal, a concept. Nothing sells it more than confidence. Not arrogance. Arrogance is not confidence. Confidence is, I know what I'm bringing to the table. I know what I expect reciprocated for it. And if the fit is not here, I will go elsewhere. That makes you incredibly desirable as an employee, as a manager, as a salesperson, as a life partner, as a student, as a member of some organization. It's a part of a network. The person that's the person you're like, you know what? Even if I don't want to do business with this person now, I want a connection with this person because I may be able to help them someday. Let me tell you another thing about sales. This is totally out in the wind from where we've been going with this. But a lot of the great deals that I made, it was due to the kindness of strangers. It was conversations in a bar. Here's a real one. I'm sitting at a bar. I'm waiting for somebody, right? I'm waiting somebody. I've got my, where my phone is right now. Somebody use a prop, right? I've got my phone sitting on the bar. I'm drinking a martini. There's a dude, like, he comes in, and he's like the kind of guy that's smart enough to know, don't sit right next to somebody when there's, like, a bunch of open space. Like, sit one over at least. So he sits down, and he's diddling with shit. And he sees me, like, the third time I do this. Ugh. Put the phone down. He goes, you waiting on someone? Yeah, and we start having a conversation. And the conversation isn't so much about who I'm waiting on, but more like why I'm pissed. Like, this person asked for this meeting, and they work for me, and they're late, and I've texted them twice, and is, you know, unless they're in a hospital or something, I'm really pissed now. And it led to this whole conversation about time and how the value of time was. So we start talking. Turns out he's waiting for somebody that's also late, right? I don't even remember why, but he asked me what I do, and I tell him, I asked him what he did, and he tells me, and he's in, like, financial services, and so I don't need that, and he doesn't need computer test equipment, and he's not connected in any way in his organization to, like, IT or some shit like that, right? But we start talking, he goes, well, what are you doing in town? And I said, well, I had a meeting today with Lucent. And I'm trying to get in with those guys because I have some stuff that I think could really work for them. But I'm like at the wrong level right now. I need to find somebody else. Turned out, he's like, oh, well, what do they do? What are you looking for? And I tell him. And he goes, I don't know anybody at Lucent. But I know a guy that kind of oversees technology with the FBI. Well, okay. He picks, like, 5 minutes later, he picks the phone up, calls his friend and says, I'm talking to a guy here, and you were telling me something about your computer networks and having some problems or something. He works for a company called Fluke. Have you ever heard of them? The guy said, oh, yeah. He goes, he's sitting right here. Could he give you a call this week? And the guy said, give him my number. Tell him to call me tomorrow after 9, and I'll talk to him. He gives me the guy's number. I call him up. It was almost a $1 million deal that I closed 4 months later with that guy. Why? Because of the value of time and a shared common ideal. and I was righteously pissed off at the guy that was late, right? And if he wasn't an independent manufacturer's rep, he probably would have got fired, given I won't get into it. But that's how this shit works. Confidence, commitment, right? Those two things are in integrity. If you have confidence, commitment, and integrity, you can sell anything to anybody if the fit is right. And you don't have to worry about, like, you know, selling ice to an Eskimo. I would never consider that a compliment. If somebody told me you could sell ice to an Eskimo, I would think that you're calling me a sleazebag. Why would I sell an Eskimo ice? They have all the ice they could ever want. No, I want to sell ice to the guy in the desert. And my job to do that is to find him and to make him understand I have what he needs. And then he'll buy. That's life. So I know what you got today probably felt like an hour and a half sales seminar, and it was. But it's also the secret to getting what you really want in your life. Real quick here before I wrap up, I want to let you know about a couple things. One is we're going to have some scheduled maintenance at thesurvivalpodcast.com on August the 7th. There is a post on the blog right now, and even though I have a funny, plucky picture in the post that actually Tom the web guy made, it is because the data center that we host with, where we co-locate our server, is doing some maintenance, and we will have an outage up to 90 minutes, and the hours and everything are posted there. That way I don't get 5,000 emails telling me, hey, the site's down. We know. And we're also going to be going through some upgrades of our own as well. So that information is there, just so you know it. Next up, as I said today, I do have a product I'm recommending right now, which is Vivor's Electric Sausage Stuffer. It is awesome, and it is an investment, and you should only buy it if it makes sense for you. But I think if you check it out, you know, some of you are going to be like, yeah, this is really making a lot of sense. You might want a smaller one, a less expensive one. I give you some ideas on that as well. I will tell you, though, that learning to make sausage is an incredibly valuable skill. And all you have to do is look at what really good sausage costs and look at the raw ingredients that go into making really good or unique sausages. And then what is the cost to make it versus the cost to buy it? And even just there, even if it's not a side hustle or something, you know, like I just made a sausage for my wife and the rest of the family. It's a pork, apple, sage, fennel sausage. And when we smoked it, it came out amazing. And the whole, if you already know how to do this, the recipe is with the write-up. Go check it out. And that was fantastic. But I looked up, like, what's the closest thing I can buy that's similar? And it's almost $20 a pound. I used a pork shoulder that I paid $2 a pound for. I maybe have $3 a pound into it. So that's a profit as far as I'm concerned. And that's kind of where I'm at with things. I like to do things that are profitable. And if you run a farm, a homestead, something like that, if you're a hunter, when you learn how to make sausage, what you do is you get into the position where we really do use up everything. Because like one of the things I use in sausage all the time is liver. I'm not a fan of liver. But like 5% by weight into a sausage, in just about any sausage, liver actually, it's like salt. It makes it taste better. So there's a whole world to follow in learning to make great sausage. And I have never owned an electric sausage stuffer before. And I don't think I will ever use anything else after trying this. There's a video showing and like real, it took a little bit of a learning curve, but I've gotten to where now I can knock it out. I also am going to be making a batch of sausage this week. We'll produce some video on that, not so much the machine itself, just the sausage itself. I'm going to do a brisket jalapeno smoked sausage, and I'm going to be using smoked salt and smoked paprika as part of the ingredients list, and jalapenos from the garden and some other stuff. And I'll be putting out how to do that, regardless of whether you use a Vivor machine or anything else. And Vivor does make some really affordable manual stuffers. And I'll just tell you this about manual stuffers. If you get a really big, heavy one, it's actually pretty easy to turn the crank with one hand and feed with the other. And you get pretty good at it quick. And the beauty of that is you have a lot of control on your speed and your stop, right? Including like a half turn backward to back off pressure so it doesn't just keep oozing out when you're pinching off the end of a casing or something like that. It's okay. But you're better off with somebody else turning the crank. Like it's a two-person operation in the most convenient way possible. With an electric stuffer and a foot throttle, bro, It is so dead simple. And what I'm going to start doing, I'm going to be making a ton of sausage for the fall workshop. And I realized something. I don't need to be linking this sausage in my 6-7 inch links. I'm going to start making like long, tied off on both ends, straight sausages of about 21 inches, smoke, and then once they're smoked, they're set, and chop into, you know, 3 lengths of about 7 inches long. And so that's what I'm going to be doing. I will be bringing that to you this week in pieces and parts. I thank you for tuning in today. Tomorrow, we're going to have another episode in the rabbit series, right? We're doing a series on rabbits because not only would rabbits make a great sausage, which we learned about from our last guest. She was awesome, by the way. I think rabbit is really, for the most people, the most sustainable small property protein source. I love quail. I love chickens. I love ducks. I've had them all, and I have to buy feed for all of them. Rabbits, I think you should bring some feed in, but you can feed rabbits off the land. If you have a mixed lawn of like forbs and clovers and grass and like a little bit of fodder trees, you can feed rabbits 100% off your property. Even if you use pellets, you have the option. And that makes it infinitely sustainable. I know people like, you know, John Willis is spending almost no money on rabbit feed at all. And most of the rabbits he harvests, he feeds to his livestock guardian dogs for all the rest of the animals. Because it's zero cost. Well, the one thing I've always really wanted to get on air is someone to talk about raising rabbits colony style. Not in cages stacked up, but where all the rabbits can be rabbits and hop around. And I've heard all the reasons you can't do it. And I find all these people doing it, and nobody wants to come on and talk about it. They get the same answer from everybody. But I don't think I'm an expert. I don't think I know enough. They've been doing it for 10 years successfully. You know enough. I found a dude, and he's also a Bitcoiner. His handle is Carl Rev Hoddle. Those of you on Noster may know him. He's definitely part of the TSP community. He's kind of a mad scientist with permaculture and Bitcoin stuff. But I was on Noster right after I decided to do this whole series on rabbits, and there's a picture of these rabbits in a colony, and surrounding these big plants is fencing that the rabbits can't get to them. So he's doing like the rabbit run, and then things in there are benefiting from the rabbits being there, but the rabbits can't eat those things. And it turns out the thing growing in the protected space is cannabis. Yeah, cannabis like that. But he's not producing the cannabis to sell as a cannabis product directly. He's producing cannabis seed and then selling the seed as an income source. I'm like, dude, will you come on air? And he said, yes. And then we started talking to him. I guess with what he does not want his face. So he wanted to do audio only. I'm like, I like to do live streams, bro. So he'll have like an icon or something, like a mascot or what's the word I'm looking for. You know the thing. You know the thing, right? What is the thing, right? Can't think about what it's called now. The avatar, right? He'll have like an avatar instead of his face. That way he can protect his real IRL identity, right? But anyway, tune in for that. This is going to be awesome. Then Thursday we have the makings of a really cool expert panel show. Last week I did a thing where there were multiple experts commenting on the same thing. We're going to be doing that again tomorrow and some other really cool stuff. And then Friday flashback, and we'll do it all over again. Thanks for tuning in today. I'm going to make a commitment to you. If you take seriously what you heard today and you imply it in your life will improve. I'm not going to say you'll get everything you want. I don't know how serious you're going to take it. I'm just saying this is an episode that you may want to listen to more than once. This is an episode that if I put it on tapes and I left out some of the other peripheral shit and I sold it as like a $100 set of tapes back in the 90s, it would have done really well and nobody would have returned one. It's all free. It's all free. And this is, I want to end with this today. I do not believe in the secreting of knowledge. I think the secreting of knowledge is a sin. I do think people should be paid for what they do. It's why I build courses and things like that. And if you want it in that format and I have to put all the time into it to do that, like the home food systems courses, then I have to charge or I can't do it. But the knowledge itself, I give freely. I have never been asked a question, live stream or otherwise, and said, well, I'll only answer that if you pay me. Many times I don't even know what the answer is, but I do my best to help the person anyway. I seek somebody with the answer because if you give, you get. Let that be the last thing we take today. But let's do some questions. I almost skipped them. Builder of castles, being not normal and an Aspie, commercials do not work on me. In fact, they make me angry, so I don't believe in that kind of marketing sales. How to fix this? It does work on you. You buy shit all the time. You just identified the ones that you said no to, right? I am classic Aspie growing up, man. I took one of those online quizzes to see if you have Asperger's, and it was like, yes, you do. And then I went back through and said, I'm going to answer all these questions the way I would have answered them honestly at 15. And it was like the whole side, the essay, just blown out. Nothing normal about you at all. But it doesn't matter if it doesn't work on you as the prospect. This was my biggest challenge when I got into sales. Things that I knew wouldn't work on me, I didn't want to do to others because I was like, well, then, you know, they'll say no. Turns out, like, You have to work to the average, right? You have to follow the formulas that work. And you can develop your own way of doing it, right? That's a pretty deep question. I can only answer that so much. But I might do some follow-up on that. Like, how do you get over some of the Asperger's stuff is more the question, I think, than how to sell if you are an Asperger's person. Because as long as you learn certain social cues and rules, I think it actually makes you better as a salesperson because you recognize patterns. That's one of the advantages of being an Aspie, is that you get really good at pattern recognition. And so once you can recognize certain patterns, maybe ones that you weren't attuned to, now you can channel them. Larry says, after a $20 super chat, made you look, you stream when my morning meetings happen for work, so I seldom get to listen to and participate properly. I love what you do. Here's some money. Thank you, Larry, for giving me money. I appreciate that. And thank you for your kind words. Legacy Farm and Homestead says, where did you get that shirt? I already answered that. SOE Tactical Gear. 9 times out of 10, that is the answer. The Santos Live says, do you subscribe to customer profiling, identifying psychological types, and selling to that? I forget what the old school book is called. Less so than I believe in data raking. So if you have access to a database and that database gives you certain characteristics, and you have a specific product, and you have a good analyst working that database set, they can pare that database down. So like when I worked for Sage Telecom, which was a local phone service provider, when we brought in internet as a co-service, we had 500,000 customers, and we wanted to send an email. Then we didn't want to send it to a bunch of people that didn't want it, right, even if we could legally do so. So the marketing analyst that worked there raked the data based on my inputs, and we raked that down to about 50,000 key prospects. We emailed that, and we got something like 10,000 orders. So we got like a 20% hit rate. If we would have sent it to the whole thing, we probably would have got one. Now, you would say, why not just send it to everybody? Because there was other types of follow-up those people fell into. It was a very large company, so there's certain silos that you create. But I do think that there is certain psychology types that are more prone to say yes. But I think that's more of a victimization. So my late father-in-law was like that, man. He was a salesman's dream, especially a sleazy salesman's dream. He couldn't say no to people. I really don't know much about that because I don't like victimizing people. You know, it's just not my thing. If you do remember the name of that book, I would like to at least peruse the concept. Email me, Santos, and just put TSPC in the subject line and let me know it. And then Santos has another one. How do you deal with the sheer stupidity of the public? Okay, I'm not even going to read anymore. All right, I already told you. You create three categories of prospect. Probably, possibly, and never. When you're dealing with stupidity, it's a never. Out. And here's the thing. If you throw out all the nevers, occasionally you'll make a mistake. And you may never see that person again or even know that you did. But you could have a person that would have eventually said yes. But they will eat so much of your time and so much of your resources that you could have converted 5 or 6 or 7 or 10 others that you won't convert because you didn't give them the time because you're trying to hold this person's hand through. That reeks of desperation too. So if you get good at filtering, you don't have to worry about that because stupid people go away. We live in this world where there's a phone in every hand, and the number one thing people want to video is somebody doing something stupid because it gets the most attention. It's funny, but what it does is it skews our perception of reality to where we think this is the average person. The average person isn't stupid. If the average person isn't stupid, the trains wouldn't run on time, the buses wouldn't roll on time, nobody would get anywhere, everybody that went to the hospital would die, right? Like, the average person isn't stupid, but we only see the stupid. And then people are stupid or ignorant subjectively, right, individually. So this person that knows nothing about computers, and I'm trying to sell a computer product, I'm better off not talking to them. I don't have the time to hold their hand and go 5 years of training so they can do that somewhere else, and eventually I'll find them again. That's how you do that. You filter. Remember that. That's what I'm going to close with. You filter all prospective people. No matter you're looking for a job, you're looking for a date, you're looking to sell a product, doesn't matter, into probables, possibles, and nevers. And find that as quick as you can. Get to know fast, because then you can prospect somebody else. My wife gets pissed at me when I'm like with a salesperson. I shut them down, and I'm a little bit rude about it, because I'm like, I'm done. Because they weren't respectful of my time, so I have to take my time back. And I'm like, if that person's good at what they do, they should appreciate me. Because I've self-filtered. Like, that was the person that just tells me to fuck off when I was in sales, love it. I will not waste 1 second more on this person. There's no reason to. I will talk to somebody else. The only time that becomes a problem is when you're given a strategic objective, like get into this company, and that person's in a position where you have to talk to them. That's the exception. The exceptions are not the rule, though. Take care, guys. I'll catch you tomorrow with that great episode on raising rabbits in the colony.
They said you should have a house the American way. Dollar down, a dollar a month, and you never have to pay. Show you a better way.